Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, the view from corporate America, from American public media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday today, the 6th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. And we begin today with a variation on one of my favorite questions. Jay Powell gets the day off, and we ask instead, what is corporate America thinking? We get pretty regular updates to what publicly traded companies are thinking, quarterly, in fact, when they deliver their regular earnings reports using way more than five words, just for the record. But over the past couple of weeks, a bunch of companies have been warning that their revenues the next couple of quarters, well, it's just not going to be as good as they had been telling us they would be. So Marketplace's Justin Ho set off to find out how come.
Start with the fact that people aren't buying as much of the stuff that was popular earlier in the pandemic, like casual apparel. Christina Boney is an analyst at Moody's.
We're starting to see and have seen a transition to services as consumers have come back out in terms of entertainment and travel and dining.
Many consumers are also cutting back because of higher prices, especially when it comes to discretionary purchases.
We're talking about decorating, right? Small appliances, things that you would be using in your kitchen or in your living room, those types of items.
Boney says this is happening the most with middle to lower income consumers. In fact, the retailer Gap recently said inflation has been hurting sales of its cheaper brands. Lindsay Piegza, chief economist at Stifel, says businesses know that consumers won't be able to keep spending forever.
Consumers have already eaten through much, if not all, of their pandemic savings.
As a result, Piegza says many businesses are worried about raising prices too much, so they're looking for ways to cut costs.
When we talk about investment, when we talk about hiring, we're only now beginning to see the early indications of businesses responding by cutting back.
That's also starting to affect companies that sell to other businesses, such as social media platforms, where consumer-facing firms advertise, says Dan Ives, an analyst at Wedbush Securities.
If companies fear a slowdown, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. They'll pull back. The first thing they pull back is advertising.
The social media company Snap recently lowered its revenue forecast because it says the, quote, macroeconomic environment has deteriorated further and faster than anticipated. Ive says that means businesses are spending less on ads.
Which is why when Snap warned, the worry is that it's just the first shoe to drop in a softening consumer.
Ive says that softness could start to show up with other tech platforms, such as Google, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, look, first of all, do yourself a favor. Pay no attention to Elon Musk and his grumblings about that contract he signed to buy Twitter at $54.20 a share. He is just trolling us for reals. Twitter today, oh, look, down 1.5%, $39.56 a share. Musk kind of did it to himself. Otherwise, though, a fairly calm day at the corner of Wall Street and Broad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Shanghai and Beijing are slowly coming out of lockdown, but it has been a long, long haul. More than 60 days for people in Shanghai, like Marketplace's Jennifer Pack, not being allowed out of their homes. So the very basics, like getting enough to eat, became daily challenges. So the subsistence supply chain over there became a daily necessity. Here's Jennifer.
The first proper food delivery I had during lockdown was a month after being sealed in my home.
Ni hao. For a moment, the barbecue ribs, burger, and fries gave me and my boyfriend a feeling of normalcy. Before the lockdown, interactions with delivery folks like this were frequent. Need onions for the pasta tonight? Craving bubble tea? All that could be delivered within 30 minutes for less than $2. Then Shanghai locked down, and the supply chain collapsed. Long Wang of ProA Supply Chain is in Shanghai.
During the lockdown, all these delivery people are not allowed to leave their home.
The government also sealed the city border, which was bad, he says, because most of the warehouses are just outside of Shanghai. Businesses were shut and had to apply to reopen. Not a lot of food services got permission.
The attitude from the central government is that you have to be strict. So they are only letting the most essential, for example, medical supply, to go through.
Suddenly, 10 million plus households, including Marketplace's news assistant Charles Zhang's, had to wake up at the crack of dawn to fight for delivery spots. The process is so complex, friends circulated an Excel spreadsheet on what time different apps started taking orders. I got one delivery slot. But by the time I checked out, the only thing left in my virtual cart was a case of Qingdao beer. And when we hear this tune, it's time for either another PCR test or a government handout. 1 week it was three potatoes, bok choy, and two chunks of pork. Helpful, but we didn't know when we'd get another. So I relied on my neighbors who organized bulk buys. They're pricey. Like, I paid $70 for a grocery box set, and all I wanted were the eggs and meat. Not great for consumers, but easier for suppliers. Again, supply chain expert Long Wang.
By everybody eating the same thing, you save lots of manual labors in terms of picking and sorting and packaging, right? So instead of you getting ABC, he getting XYZ, everybody get DEF.
I also have friends and underground channels to source soy sauce, instant noodles, even ice cream bars. Back on the 27th day of the lockdown, we got our eighth handout, bean curd sticks and gluten, stuff I've not cooked with. But we were lucky. Some districts received only half the handouts. Fed-up residents were shown in a video banging pots and pans to demand more food. People flooded hotlines with complaints, including one man whose call with his district government was widely circulated.
Up to now, medics cannot save lives, children cannot go to school, workers cannot work, and we tolerated it all. Chinese people are very peaceful, but once you touch our ability to eat and survive, that's crossing a line.
Perhaps the hardest hit are delivery drivers. Again, supply chain expert Long Wang.
After they leave their home, they cannot go back. So you have seen reports that people are living under the bridge. They are subject to daily testing. They have a tough time finding things to eat, even though they are delivering food to people.
Shanghai is phasing out restrictions, but that could change if there are new COVID cases. As for me, I've still got a few vegetables to stir fry. And if there's a snap lockdown again, I've got 9 jugs of vinegar, 33 pounds of rice, and 12 boxes of cereal. In Shanghai, where I'm free to move about for now, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Let me just give the plug for Jennifer's Instagram one more time if you want to see what it's been like for her over there. It's JPak Radio. That's J, the letter J. P-A-K Radio, all one word, on Instagram. And look, while I'm at it, if you miss anything on the air, please feel free to follow our podcast, would you, on the platform of your choice. Among the many, many things that happened in this economy as the pandemic hit two something years ago was that the federal government's school lunch program got bigger. A lot bigger. And since the spring of 2020, the Agriculture Department, which, yes, is in charge of school lunches, has issued more than 100 waivers that let all school kids get free breakfast and lunch at school. But the authority to grant those waivers evaporates at the end of this month. Congress could extend it, but that seems unlikely. So Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer took a look at how kids could be affected this summer and next school year.
One of the USDA waivers relaxed a rule that only allowed summer meal programs in communities where at least 50% of the students already qualified for free lunch programs. Diane Pratt-Hevner is with the School Nutrition Association, a trade group for school cafeteria workers.
Thanks to the waivers, local schools and community groups could determine where to set up their meal sites based on demand and based on need.
The anti-poverty group Share Our Strength estimates that 1 out of 5 summer meal sites that were open last year won't be open this summer. Rachel Sabella is director of Share Our Strength's No Kid Hungry New York program. She says that means
it could jeopardize access to summer meals for nearly 7 million children across the country.
Plus, those summer meal sites that are open won't be able to hand out food to go. They'll have to serve sit-down meals at specific times. That doesn't mesh with some parents' schedules. Also, the government will reinstate income limits families have to meet for free school meals. Rebecca Wood, a single mom in the Boston area, makes just above the limit. She says before the USDA made meals free for all students, she struggled to pay her daughter's school cafeteria bill.
She was in first grade, and they were telling her that I needed to pay her debts. And it was just heartbreaking because I was doing the best I could. I just couldn't keep up.
Also, there can be a stigma around the free lunch program that discourages families from applying. Crystal Fitzsimons at the Food Research and Action Center says that's a problem.
Participation in school meals has been shown to reduce absenteeism, reduce tardiness, improve student behavior, and improve academic achievement.
Fitzsimons says many school districts are still in crisis mode, and this is not the time to drop the waivers that help them feed hungry students. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's a set price. It's an all-inclusive package.
All right, then. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 16 today, less than a 10%, 32,915. The NASDAQ rose 48 points, about 0.4%, 12,061. The S&P 500 picked up 12, 0.3%, ended things at 41.21. Tipping appears to have dropped off a bit since the start of the pandemic. A new survey from creditcards.com shows 73% of Americans said they always tip at a sit-down restaurant, down from 77% in 2019. Bond prices were down. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 3.04%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Talking about pay in this economy, salaries, hourly wages, whatever you want to call it. It's always been, well, first of all, awkward, right? But also for a lot of companies, officially frowned on. They just don't want people talking about how much money they make. And so more than a dozen states have or are considering what are called pay transparency laws, where companies would have to post salary ranges and job listings or not be allowed to ask applicants how much they made at their last job and or not be allowed to punish people for talking about their pay. The idea is that these laws can help stop pay discrimination. But still, a lot of companies offer the lowest salaries they can, and that tends not to work real well as more people are more open about their pay. Marketplace's Mariel Segura has our story.
Mason Vallis is 25, lives in Chicago, and works in customer service. And the other day, she posted this video on TikTok.
Listen, I need these companies and these hiring managers to grow up and, like, get a grip on reality, okay?
Vallis recently applied for a job as a receptionist at a medical spa. She got an interview, and at the end, the hiring manager told her the pay, which she said was too low.
And he was like, yeah, you know, here's the thing. There's a lot more here to gain than just money. And we're looking for people that are motivated by more than just money.
In this case, Vallis thinks he meant a sense of community or that maybe the spa was a nice environment to work in. But this kind of comment, it's a way an employer or a hiring manager can make you feel like it's shameful that you want more money, that you're being greedy even, as if a job isn't an exchange of labor for money. So, okay, back to her TikTok.
I don't know what fantasy world you're living in where people are letting you pay them in, like, gold star stickers or whatever the f***, but I live in the real world where people need money to survive.
Like, sorry, my landlord doesn't accept gold star stickers, so Now, I talked to Valez later. She didn't actually say all this to him in this way, but she did tell him, yeah, I do have to consider money.
You know, at that point, he was just kind of like, all right, well, you know, I guess this concludes the interview.
Valez didn't have another job lined up, but she was fine with that.
I have no problem turning stuff down, even if I don't have a backup plan. Like, I am not going to accept less than I think I'm worth.
Some employers will act like it's inappropriate to even ask about pay. Quinn Pons is 34, lives in Portland, Oregon, and is a coordinator for mental health programs. She recently applied for a job. They emailed her. She asked about the pay.
And they were saying that they couldn't even, like, share that it was an HR situation, meaning, you know, you have to already apply, interview, I guess get hired, and then they'll tell you how much you're making.
Pond says people put a lot of work into job interviews. They might have to take time off, pay for gas, get dressed up, do some sort of homework, often for free. So she decided to say something.
I professionally just let them know that that was just not acceptable, that as somebody who is a person who hires that, I would never tell somebody that they'd have to jump through those hoops before telling them.
She says the company never responded. Why are companies so reluctant to share salary numbers with applicants? Chris Collins, who teaches HR studies at Cornell, says it's about the escalation of commitment.
If I were being cynical, the more effort you put in as an applicant, the harder it is to turn down the offer.
Collins says waiting until the last minute to reveal the pay is a terrible practice, by the way, because you're wasting time interviewing people who may never take the job. He suggests that smaller companies that can't afford to pay market rate should be upfront about that.
But list or give them information on all the other things that maybe make up for it. So whether that's additional benefits or time off or flexibility.
Whether it's a 4-day work week or working from home, those things can have value. It's just the last few years have been hard. People are burnt out and working more hours than ever. And Jamie Cohn, a research director in the HR practice at Gartner, says workers are skeptical when companies say things like,
we're all a family, we care about you, those sorts of things. And they're saying, actually, I provide a service and you need to pay me fairly for that service.
Sometimes that means walking away from job interviews when the pay is too low or when the pay is a big secret. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
The very first Formula One Grand Prix in Miami happened last month. Max Verstappen, driving for Red Bull, took the checkered flag. And the sport, always well-heeled and quite the thing among the moneyed F1 crowd, is only getting bigger. Netflix and Amazon are competing to get Formula One rights in America. And there's a case to be made that F1's influence extends beyond the track and the broadcast rights. Dr. Kit Chapman is the author of a book called Racing Green, How Motorsport Science Can Save the World, in which he calls motorsport the world's fastest R&D lab.
Well, let's take aerodynamics, for example. What you probably don't realize is that if you've been to the supermarket this week and you've reached into one of those open freezers, you've actually used Formula One aerodynamics, because on the edges of all of those freezer units, they actually use the wings that were designed in Formula One to curb back that cold air instead of it falling out onto you. And that means that you're reducing the amount of energy you use because you're using less cold air, it reduces your carbon footprint, and it keeps your feet warm. So there is just one example.
Formula E, the electric car racing circuit. I learned in this book that those cars, and of course they can, and this is me just not really being on top of it, they can recharge during the race, right?
They absolutely can. So they've got what's called regenerative braking, so that you're taking the energy that you're using while you're braking, and that's powering a little motor in your car, and they can now recharge about 40% of the energy that they're actually using just in this generation. The next generation, it's going to be even more efficient. And that means that their batteries can last longer, they can keep going for longer, and obviously that directly impacts on whether or not we can use electric cars on our roads.
Right. Say more about that, because the charging part of electric vehicles is the bugaboo, right? Range anxiety and battery running down and being lousy in cold weather and uphills and all that.
Absolutely. So the things that we look at in batteries, there's two different categories. You've got power density, that's how much power you can give immediately, and energy density, how much energy you've got that you can use over time. And because Formula E is all about energy density, because you want to keep those cars going around the track as fast as you can for as long as you can, that means that we actually get that increased range. The thing we're looking at now is fast charging. So the idea of being able to essentially drive over, and as you would charge your phone sort of remotely, you put it on a little pad. Maybe we can do that with cars as well. They're also branching into what's called extreme E. So can we charge cars in Patagonia or Argentina or Senegal? And we can. We're doing that with rally cars and extreme E.
Extreme E, that's wild. What do you imagine the next, you know, I don't know. I mean, this stuff moves so fast, right? So I'll limit it to 10 years. The next decade in automotive innovation as it translates to the civilian sphere.
I think AI cars are going to be absolutely huge. We're seeing increased sort of automated driving. The other thing we're going to see is probably tires coming from entirely different ideas of where you'd think. So most people will know about rubber being in tires, natural rubber. We're starting to use natural rubber in dandelions. If you've ever seen a dandelion, if you ever squeezed the bottom of it and got that white stuff out there, dandelion rubber, we are already using that to make tires.
Wow. Would you ride in an AI powered car? I mean, where are you on the whole? This is, you know, you wrote a whole book on cars and technology and innovation. Would you ride in a driverless car?
I absolutely would. I mean, I have had a go, and it's great fun. I was actually more scared of riding around in a 3D printed car, a car that had been entirely 3D printed. But that held together very well as well.
Oh, my goodness. Kit Chapman, Dr. Kit Chapman, his new book on automotive technology and how it translates into the civilian sphere is called Racing Green. Dr. Chapman, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
June is traditionally peak wedding month. Not that you gotta be traditional about getting married, but for all you couples planning to tie the knot this year sometime, you are part of a pretty staggering statistic. According to the Wedding Report, there are going to be about 2.5 million weddings this year. That is the highest that number's been in decades. You know what else is the highest it's been in decades? Yes, of course you do. Inflation. And let's face it, even in 2% CPI times, weddings ain't cheap. So in this economy, and for those on a budget, micro weddings could be here to stay. We talked to Gretchen Culver last year. She owns Rocket Science Events, and she is also the creator of Mini Weddings.
Since we last spoke, my micro wedding businesses have been booming. In fact, I was able to launch another branch in Chicago, and I've been able to hire more staff. We have definitely encountered some challenges. The supply chain for floral is just crazy right now. And also the costs have tripled and quadrupled in some instances, or even more. When we launch our micro wedding date, it's a set price, it's an all-inclusive package, and I have contracted with the vendors that are going to provide the service for that date. I cannot raise my package price for the couples once it's been set, so we have been, in some instances, reducing our profit in order to pay our vendors and partners more to make sure that that experience is the best that it can be for our couples. And moving forward, as we're looking to launch new dates, we are definitely keeping our pricing top of mind because we just don't know when inflation will go down or when supply chain will get back to normal. So we just need to be cognizant of how we're putting our offerings together. What started out as a COVID pivot is now becoming a hopefully mainstay business for me. And I'm very excited and I'm looking forward to the future because I do really feel that small weddings and micro weddings are here to stay. When couples show up and they have this great small wedding experience and it's everything that they wanted, and knowing that this business model is going to endure, at least for the foreseeable future, and that we'll be able to keep creating amazing memories for couples
hopefully across the country.
That was Gretchen Culver at Minneapolis Mini Wedding Professional Plan. Final note on the way out today, data from the office entry system company Castle. They do those card readers and stuff that you got to wave at the thing to get in the door. Anyway, Bank of America has the data, which shows office occupancy rates over the past month or so. Where's it been? Any guesses percentage-wise? Yeah, so it's 43%. But more to the point, that occupancy rate has been flat 5 straight weeks now. Work is changing, gang. Work is changing. Okay, we're going, but here's your moment of economic context that comes to us courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. The Congressional Budget Office says individual income tax collections are set to hit $2.6 trillion in the fiscal year that ends at the end of September. That is a bit more than 10.5% of the entire American economy. It is also a record for the 109 years that the individual income tax has been around. Our daily production team includes Anis Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.